Okay, does everyone understand the question? The disciplinary question, that is to say, the there was a question about the rules, the Vinaya rules that came up at the first council. What was that question? What was that issue? Yes, precisely. I just mentioned that toward the end of his life, the Buddha told Ananda that the Sangha might do away with the lesser rules if it saw fit, and so this was raised at the first council. And what was the difficulty there? Yes. Yes, exactly. The Ananda had not asked the Buddha which were the minor precepts, and so it was decided to leave all the precepts unchanged. So that's good enough for the first part of the question. Now the second part of the question about Purana's attitude, you remember the incident, the episode where Purana turns up at the council toward the end of its deliberations.
What happened?
He was referred to remember the Buddha's teaching in the way he has studied.
Right. He was asked to join in the recitation, and he politely declined, saying that he would prefer to remember the Buddha's teaching as he had heard it himself from the Buddha. Now what is the significance of this?
There could be other versions what was recited at the council.
Yes, absolutely. So again, you see, this is helps to explain, you know, how there could arise other interpretations or other traditions that differed in a greater or lesser degree from the Theravada tradition. Okay, we go to the next question.
What was the issue that led to the convening of the second council? Discuss the consequences of the decision taken by the council.
Yes, absolutely. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes, I can. The Vijayan monks, after the council, was excommunicated, if that's the word that you can use, and Mahasanghika's group parts from the Sastra Vira Vadis. At issue is the Mahasanghika's reluctance to accept the decisions of the council. This marks the skepticism and the beginning that would evolve into the Mahayana Buddhist.
Yes, first of all, when we talk about the issue that led to the calling of the council, our venerable friend here mentioned the 10 points, and it might be good to give one or two examples of what those 10 points were. The one that I think will remain in everyone's memory. Okay, yeah, but there's one that's even more. I mean, that's one example, but then there's another one. Accepting gold and silver. I think that this was probably the issue that precipitated, because if you recall the accounts of the council, one of the elder monks was visiting the Vijayan country and he saw them putting out vessels in which people were depositing coins of gold and silver and so forth, and then he said that this isn't right, and they said, well, you just go on your way and leave us alone, this is what we do. And so then he went back and he consulted with other elders, and everyone decided that this wasn't good. And then, of course, in addition to that, there were various other things like keeping salt in the hollow, in a hollowed out horn, and then all sorts of things, taking two meals a day, right? Having one meal in one village and then going to another village and having another meal. There was something about the kind of sitting mat. Yes, there were some. There were a number of points. But if you mention one or two, if you mention the issue about accepting, well, I mean that would certainly. I mean, for those of you who are gifted with good memories and can memorize all 10, then that will be.
They accepted God for you.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So. So if you can remember, I mean, there was another one about, you know, getting permission for an act after doing it, you know, that was also an infringement. So there were a number. So you don't, I mean, it's not necessary that you mention all of them, but certainly if you can mention one or two, it gives it more substance. Your answer will have more facts, more evidence. Then regarding the consequences, yes, I mean, what you say is in general terms is correct. The school were, the elders were known as, in this case, they had Staviravadins, Staviravadins, which of course is just in Sanskrit, the Sanskrit equivalent of Theravada. Stavira means elder, just as Thera means elder. So the elder monks excommunicated or censured, let's say, you know, told them to mend their ways. The monks who were guilty of these 10 practices. A lot of people at the council, the junior monks and a lot of the lay people, thought that this was a bit severe and that it wasn't such an important issue after all. And so then we have the emergence of the Mahasanghikas. But exactly how the Mahasanghikas emerged, we really don't know. A lot of the earlier textbooks suggest that the Mahasanghikas immediately went off and had their own council. There are other indications that this took them a little bit of time. But yes, we can say that the Mahasanghikas, you know, that one of the consequences of the Second Council was a schism between the Staviravadins, the elders, and the Mahasanghikas, which were the sort of popular party, you know, the Bolsheviks, the popular party, the one that had more adherents, not among the senior monks, not among the elder monks, but among the younger, the junior monks and the laity. And that this was the beginning of a process of, what shall we say, decentralization, schism, you can call it a schism if you like. I mean, it was the beginning of a process which saw the emergence of many schools. It's difficult to defend the idea that the Mahayana arose directly out of the Mahasanghikas. If you put that down on your question paper, I won't take marks off for it, but I won't also give you any extra marks for it because it's an oversimplification. It led to the emergence of many different schools. After the Second Council, we had, yes, the Mahasanghikas, but then we have various other schools. So that by the time of the Third Council, we have 18 schools. Various schools of the Mahasanghikas, the various schools of the Staviravadins, the Sarvastivadins, the Vatsiputriyas, etc., etc. So in general, we can say that the consequences of the Council was that the Buddhist community began to fragment, or it began to divide and subdivide into various schools. That much we can say without any fear of overstating our point or of misrepresenting what happened. We know for certain it is a fact that after the Second Council, the Buddhist community divided into a number of schools. considerable number of schools, different schools. So this is certainly one of the consequences of the council. Okay, so we should go now to the next question.
Who were the principal protagonists at the third council? What were some of the consequences of the council?
The third council was under the sponsorship of King Pierre Asuka and presided by Pasang Mongkali Putra. And they were very much inclined toward the Savastivadians. And during the council, they recited the Abhidhamma Pitaka along with sections of the Kutaka Nikaya.
Katavatu was composed, yes, but I think we would put that into the second answer. That would be part of the answer to the second part of the question. The first part really says who the protagonist is. A word that you may not be, not all of you will be familiar with. What I really mean is who were the principal players, and of course you mentioned two. You mentioned the Emperor Ashoka and you mentioned Moggallitissa. Which of course they count as major players, but in addition, what I really had in mind were the schools, the parties. Who were the parties that were involved or that were important at the time of the Third Council? Yes, Vibhajavadins are one, Sarvasivadins are another, and in a sense you can also mention, if you like, the Vatsiputriyas, because the council was also meant to cleanse or to expel, to drive away the Vatsiputriyas, who were considered to be somewhat heretical because of their belief in this Pudgala, in this personality that was neither identical with nor different from the Skandhas. But the finalists, so to speak, if we think of the council as a sort of a World Cup of football or something like that, the finalists were the Sarvastivadins and the Vibhajavadins. And these were both schools of the Staviravada. They were both, schools that were basically conservative schools. It was not, the council was not favorable toward the Sarvastivadins. Actually, the council decided in favor of the Vibhajavadins, and the Sarvastivadins were driven out, chased away, so to speak, by the council. They were declared to be in the wrong. So to summarize the answer to the question, who were the principal protagonists, and maybe I'll use another term rather than protagonist, but the short answer is, all right, Emperor Ashoka, under whose patronage the council was called, Moggallitissa, who presided over the council. And then as far as the schools are concerned, well, you can say the Vatsiputriyas were a kind of indirect cause for the calling of the council, but then the main fight was between the Vibhajavadins and the Sarvastivadins. The Vibhajavadins won, Sarvastivadins were declared to be heretical or wrong, their teaching was declared to be not in keeping. Then when we come to the consequences, as our friend over here said, the council composed the Katavatu, which was a kind of work that discussed the views of the various schools and refuted the views of many. And then other consequences of the council? Yes, absolutely, absolutely right. And particularly successful among those missions was the mission to Sri Lanka, right? And the establishment of the Vibhajavada tradition in Sri Lanka. So that is the founding of the Theravada tradition of Sri Lanka, which still exists today. Other consequences? Well, yes, I mean, I would say, someone else give, have a shot, somebody else give it a go. It has to do with a very pretty place in the Himalayas. Kashmir, yeah, the Sivastivadins all went to Kashmir. So their punishment, actually, of having to go to Kashmir was not much of a punishment, because first of all, it was a very nice place, and secondly, in Kashmir, they were perfectly placed geographically to influence the newly emerging Buddhist countries of Central Asia. This was right on the trade routes, and it was just perfect for them to be able to spread their influence into Central Asia, Afghanistan, Kashmir, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and all these Khotan, as it was known in those days. All these areas became very much influenced by the Sarvastivadins. So this was also a kind of, the council did not intend this as a consequence, but this was a consequence of the council, that the Sarvastivadins moved to Kashmir, and there they became a very powerful sect and influenced the Buddhism of northwestern India and Central Asia quite profoundly in the years to come. So these are other, these are the two main consequences, I would say. The missions, well, three. The composition of the Katavattu, the missions that were sent out by the emperor, and particularly the very successful mission to Sri Lanka, and then finally the deportation or the migration of the Sarvastivadins to Kashmir, where they then became a very influential sect. So I would say these are the consequences of the Third Council. Okay, next question.
Is there evidence of Mahayana doctrines in the Pali Canon? Cite as many examples as you can.
Okay, now this is one which you can, you all have a lot of, there's a lot of material to draw upon. Remember when you answer your question papers, when you write your question papers, discipline yourselves, you know, you have 3 hours to answer 5 questions. That's about a half an hour for each question, and a half an hour to look over the answers, a half an hour to read all the questions and select, half an hour to look over the answers. So don't spend more than a half an hour on any one question. But this is a question which, you know, has a lot of, the answer can be quite extensive. But anyway, let someone start. Is there evidence of Mahayana doctrines in the Pali canon, in the Pali sources, and give some examples of such Mahayana doctrines or suggestions or evidence of Mahayana doctrines, traces of Mahayana doctrines in the Pali sources.
In Uttaka Nikaya, Uttaka Nikaya, there is a sutta, Mogadaya Sutta. They are mentioned about the Sunya. Sunya Doroka Nadika Sutta, Mogadaya Adara. Mogadaya, you see the world with mindfully as a Sunya. This world, actually the Maya, they stand. They are just being Sunya Nidam Nikkali Atrena Atrena. That means you see yourself as an emptiness. Actually, this word, Mahayana has get from the Theravada. After that, they expanded as a Sinyatavada, the Majjhimika Kalika. Like that. Vijnanavada also say, Mano Kubbam Dhamma Dhamma Mano Setta Mano Maya. The mind is the runner. Actually here, only Chetasika side, not only everything. But actually they misunderstood that the Lord Buddha's word, and they explained it as a Vijnanama.
Okay, that's very good. Actually, that's a very good beginning. Whether they misunderstood or not, I don't know, but that my opinion won't come into the into it at this point. I mean, I think that that's a very good beginning to this answer. So anyone else has got something to add? Okay, this is fair enough. Yes, I mean this is also relevant. Then we have a lot of other. Right, exactly. This is the Buddha's decision to teach the Dharma. That's another point. And then. Yes, okay, good. That's one. That's something I didn't mention, but it's a valid point, yes.
The 10 perfects and the Dasaparamita, in Theravada, giving a dana, that is the first parami. In Mahayana, giving panya. But if both, I think, go the same way. Because
we
say the Lord Buddha, Mahaprabhu, actually when he is giving Dana, Dana is charity. Yes. Charity, actually without compassion, we can't do that. Actually, the karma, kosara, parisaita, parami, Dana, Parami, the karuna and Panya should go hand in hand. Actually, the both side, I think, the Theravada and the Mahayana goes the same way, parallel way. Without compassion, actually, when we develop the wisdom, I think that used, when we become, actually, without wisdom, when we develop the karuna, compassion, I think that could also be useless, because then we become dead side.
Yes.
That's why I think both dhyana actually go by similar parallel way.
No, you're absolutely true. You're absolutely right. I mean, this is what social workers have been learning for the last 20 or 30 years, that compassion without wisdom is useless. So that's absolutely right. And it's also true. I mean, dana paramita is the first of the paramitas of the Mahayana also. We didn't get a chance to talk too much about it, but it is the first of the perfections in the Mahayana system as well. So that's absolutely right. What you're saying is absolutely right. But I'm still looking for a couple of other traces, a couple of other bases of Mahayana, or anticipations or reflections of Mahayana in the Pali texts. Upaya Kaushalya, okay, good. But what about views? What about the Buddha's attitude toward views? You know, I mean, what about Kachyana Gota Sutta? What about the Chulamalunkya? What about the Buddha's silence with regard to the, you know, the 14 or the 10 questions? I mean, this is also an anticipation of Mahayana. It's an anticipation of Mahayana, first of all, in the form, because the Chatuskoti, the four alternative formulation of the views that the Buddha refused to endorse. This is used by Nagarjuna in the Karika. It's commonly used in the Mahayana. And also because the Buddha refused to endorse any of these views. He's teaching the middle way that goes beyond existence and non-existence. And what the Mahayana teaches in Shunyavada and so forth is going beyond existence and non-existence. And when the Buddha says to Kachyana Gota that, you know, the world is used to relying on existence and non-existence, but the Buddha teaches from the middle way, from the middle position, and he teaches what is not existent and what is not non-existent, and he teaches interdependent origination. So I think you should mention this, you know, which is very frequently mentioned in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's silence, the Buddha's refusal to endorse, to accept any of these extreme views, and that's, you know, very much similar to the Mahayana attitude toward the alternatives of existence, non-existence, eternity, and destructibility, and so on. So that's one thing that you should mention. And that, of course, the Buddha says, instead of, because I teach from the middle, I teach the middle way, I teach interdependent origination. And interdependent origination is also a basis of shunyata. Because in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I don't remember now exactly which sutta it is, but in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha says the flame in the oil lamp burns depending on the oil in the wick. It's nothing in itself. It's not in the wick and it's not in the oil. And similarly, all phenomena, all things, all dhammas are, you know, without any self-existence. And then he goes on to talk about how they are like foam and like bubbles and so forth. So there are a number of texts and a number of places where we see evidence of Mahayana doctrines or traces of Mahayana doctrines. We have the Alagotabama Sutta, the Sutta of the water snake, and the parable of the raft, which we see repeated precisely in the Vajracetaka. In the Diamond Sutra, we also see the Buddha referring to the parable of the raft, that all dharmas are like a raft. So there are lots of traces, lots of examples of passages in the Pali Canon that are very similar, very reminiscent, very close to the Mahayana teachings. I'm glad that you mentioned some that I hadn't thought of. I'll remember to include them the next time I talk about the subject. That's actually very, very pleased to see that. It means that you're thinking for yourselves, you're not just, you know, memorizing or throwing back at me what I gave to you. So I appreciate that. That contribution, that's very valuable. But I think you need also to look at these texts where the Buddha talks about the middle position, where he talks about avoiding the extremes of existence and non-existence, where he talks about dharmas as a raft, where he talks about the interdependent nature of things. And there's also a passage where the Buddha talks about the discourses dealing with shunyata, going beyond the world, profound discourses. And so those, unfortunately, I didn't have the text with me this time, but I can send you those references. So there are a number of points to be made here. I think a couple of you, two or three of you, are going to be working on Pali texts as your writing project, as your for your essays, and I think that, you know, you will be discovering some traces of the Mahayana in the Pali sources. The connection between interdependent origination and emptiness, the parable of the raft, the teaching the Dhamma from the middle by way of the middle, avoiding existence and non-existence, eternity and non-eternity, infinity and non-infinity, identity and difference. All of these are foundations or echoes or reflections of the Mahayana doctrines in the Pali text. So I think a lot of you need to look over again Dutta's traces, Mahayana traces in the Nikayas, and because a lot of you are overlooking some very clear indications of Mahayana teachings in the Nikayas, in the Pali texts. Our friend over here has found some that I hadn't thought of, and I congratulate him for that. I'm sorry, was that not clear? I just said that our venerable friend here has discovered some Mahayana contents in the Nikayas which I had not thought of and I had not taught, and so I thank him for that and I congratulate him for that. I mean, that's very, very much appreciated. Very good.
Seventh question. Name some of the principal Mahayana sutras. Discuss the style of the text and some of their main themes.
Okay, now this is a very general question. You don't... You need to remember the names of a few, two or three Mahayana sutras. Three, let's say three. Yeah, okay, that's sure. I mean, for the students who are, you know, practitioners in the Mahayana tradition, this will be very easy. But even for the rest of you, you can just take the three that we study. You know, the Lotus Sutra, the Heart Sutra, and the Lankavatara. And for good measure, you can throw in the Diamond Sutra if you like. So you've already got four. Now, tell me something about their style.
Repetition?
Okay. Yeah.
Simile
and parables? Yes. Very good. What are we having a sort of consultation here? What are we doing? Okay, I mean, simile and parable and repetition, or actually you can say in most cases they are also large, no? They're Vaipulya Sutras, they're known, most of them are known as, I mean, they're known in general, they're known as Vaipulya, which means voluminous, you know? They're extensive. The Heart Sutra, as I say, is an exception. The Diamond Sutra is also quite short. But most of the others, Sudharma Pundarika, the Lotus Sutra, Lankavatara, both of these are very long. Prajnaparamita Sutras also, with the exception of the Heart Sutra, are quite long, 8,000 lines and so forth. Vimalakirti Nirdesha is quite long. Samadhi Raja is long. Dashabhumika is long. They're all Vaipulya Sutras, voluminous sutras. So one thing you can say about their style is that they are verbose, if you like. You can say they're, you know, someone said repetitive, they're repetitive, they're voluminous. They're large and long. And their style, yes, it uses similes, they use a lot of similes and examples. And I think the other thing that you might say is that they are narrative or discursive, you know, the sutras don't give you any reasons. I mean, the Heart Sutra, just to take one example, the Heart Sutra doesn't say form is emptiness and then give you any reasons for that. It doesn't go into reasoning. They're declarative or didactic, as I said, didactic. I mean, they just state things. They don't defend or argue or present any systematic or logical argumentation. So that's another characteristic of the Mahayana Sutras. Now, as far as the principal themes, some of the themes, this should not be too difficult. Yes, can you just speak up a little bit? Because I'm having a hard time... having a hard time hearing your answers. Silence. The truth is inexpressible. So, well, let me. I mean, it's quite easy in a way. I mean, you can just mention three things, and it will suffice. the supramundane nature of the Buddha, which is the principal theme of the Lotus Sutra, the emptiness of all phenomena, which is the theme of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and that everything is a manifestation of mind, which is the principal theme of the Lankavatara and the Dashabhumika and so forth. So if you just mention these three, you've already mentioned some of the principal themes of the Mahayana Sutras. If you like, you can throw in skillful means, Upaya Kaushalya, which is also a theme of the Lotus Sutra and a theme of the Mahayana Sutras. So you just need to mention these three or four general themes of the Mahayana Sutras, especially supramundane, transcendental nature of the Buddha, which is really what the Lotus Sutra is on about, the use of expedient means, and then when you shift your focus over to the Perfection of Wisdom discourses, the Prajnaparamita discourses, the principal theme is emptiness, and the Lankavatara and those discourses, their principal theme is the that everything is a manifestation of mind, or that the whole phenomenal world is just mind, just a projection of mind. That is the principal theme of those discourses. Okay, so I think we can go on to the next question.
What are the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra? Describe how the sutra uses parables and similes to illustrate its message.
Okay, well, I've given you already the answer to the first part of the question. What are the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra? Supramundane nature of the Buddha, yes? Did someone say skillful means? The presence of the Buddha, yes, of course. I mean, the eternal nature of the Buddha, yes, and then the use of skillful means. And these are probably the main themes of the Lotus Sutra. You could add, for example, that everyone will eventually become a Buddha. It's another main theme of the Lotus Sutra, that even the arhats will eventually become Buddhas. The arhats receive predictions to Buddhahood and so forth. And then I would like you to mention some of the parables and similes that the sutra uses to illustrate these themes. So think of some of the parables and similes that you find in the Lotus Sutra. Very good. Yeah, that's a very good one, and I'm particularly glad because I didn't talk about it. So you found that for yourself, or you understood that for yourself. What does that show? What is the point of that story? Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. That we all have the Buddha nature, except we don't know, and you have the same message in the story of the lost son, no? The son that is lost and he doesn't know who his father is. His father sees him, but he's afraid. The son is afraid, so by stages the father brings him back into the household as a workman and so forth, and then eventually gives him his inheritance. That's the same theme. Then, of course, we have the other parables, many other parables, almost every chapter in the sutra contains a parable. Well, I don't know if that's even in the Lotus Sutra, to be honest. I mean, that's in the Pali text. The wise physician, certainly, yeah. That's one of the parables. Then there's the other one, the parable of the burning house. there's the parable of the phantom city, there's the parable of growing things, various herbs and so forth. Loads of parables and similes. So what you need to do is you identify two or three of the themes, expedient means. For example, the parable of the wise physician, it contains a couple of messages. It not only does it teach that the Buddha is really always present, the eternal or incalculable lifespan of the Tathagata, but it also is an illustration of skillful means. Also the parable about growing things, about vegetation, how the rain nourishes all the trees and shrubs and grasses according to their ability. This is again a parable about skillful means. So you need to, you know, be familiar with some of these parables and just mention them and indicate what the message of the sutra is contained in these parables. So that's the sort of answer that you need to answer this question.
9. Summarize the parable of the house on fire. What does the parable tell us about the Mahayana interpretation of the three vehicles?
Okay, so now you need to write, to recount, to retell the parable of the burning house in brief, to summarize it. Remember the story of the burning house?
He used
an expedient means, or used skillful means, yes, to get them out by telling them, yes, go ahead. So he told them that all of these carts, all these vehicles were outside, these carriages, and so they all came out of the house because of this skillful means. Okay, so you might also want to tell me who the rich man was, what the house is supposed to be, and who the children are. Yeah, the rich man, the father is the Buddha, yes. The house is the world, yes. Yes. Right. Good. So you know the children are the people of the world, right? And the fire is the suffering, the defilements, the afflictions, and so forth. Okay. So there we've retold the story. So now, what does this tell us about the Mahayana view of the vehicles, the three yanas, the Shravaka Yana, the Pratekya Buddha Yana, and the Buddha Bodhisattva Yana?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the bottom line, so to speak. But I mean, in between, the point of the parable is that the children have different likings.
Yes.
They have different inclinations. I was telling someone the other day that not everyone likes vanilla ice cream, no? So some of the children like, they want goat carts. Some of the children want deer carts. Some of the children want ox carts. So the father says, we have out here all these goat carts and deer carts and ox carts. So some of the people in the world want to get out of the world quickly. They want to attain some attain nirvana quickly, escape from the world. So for them, the Buddha taught the Shravakayana, or the way of the arhat. And other people want to gain understanding into causality and conditionality and so forth, but they want to be solitary, they don't want to teach. So for those people, there's the Pratyeka Buddhayana, the way of the individual Buddha. And then for those who want to help all living beings, who want to rescue all living beings, the Buddha taught the Bodhisattva Yana. But of course, you're right, when the children get out, these are just provisional, these are just temporary. Eventually, everybody will get the highest vehicle or the best carriage, which is the Bodhisattva carriage, or the the Mahayana vehicle, the Bodhisattva vehicle. So the point is, what does the parable tell us about the Mahayana view of the three vehicles? Well, what it tells us is that the three vehicles are expedient means. The three vehicles are convenient devices, and they are taught in accordance with the inclinations of living beings. Just as we can see it in this same classroom, we can see that some people, you know, they're not inclined toward the Mahayana. They feel frightened by the Mahayana. They feel confused by the Mahayana. So for these people, that is why there's a Shravakayana. That is why there's a Theravada. I don't know if we have any potential Pratyeka Buddhas here, but supposing we do, so there's a vehicle for the Pratyeka Buddhas, and then there's a vehicle for those who, you know, are attracted to the Mahayana ideal, which is the Bodhisattva vehicle. So the vehicles are just devices, they're just convenient means, skillful means, in order to bring living beings along toward liberation. Eventually, the message of the sutra and the message in this chapter as well is that eventually everyone will become Buddhas, everyone will be put onto the Buddha path. But in the meantime, because of the different inclinations of different living beings, there are other vehicles. So, you know, we can't make this kind of, I don't suppose, you know, we can make this distinction among varieties of ice cream. Which is the best variety of ice cream? Is it chocolate? Is it strawberry? Is it vanilla? I don't know. But the point is, whatever is the best kind of ice cream, everyone gets the best kind of ice cream in the end. But as a device, you know, because some children like vanilla, some children like strawberry. So, you know, you have this variety of vehicles, this variety of toys. So it's skillful means to bring living beings out of the burning house that is the world, you know, that is afflicted by suffering, that is samsara. Bring them out. Then once you get them out, you see, even if you get them out by means of the goat carts, then you can always talk about the deer carts or the oxen carts, you know. So it's a skillful device, it's a convenient means, an expedient means for getting the children out. And the three vehicles are just different means, which all of them eventually, sooner or later, will lead to the same end, which is the end of Buddhahood.